The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast for February 23rd, 2022. It's your old pal, Justin Robert Young. So we're going to war? Now we are we at war? These are the questions being asked after Monday's actions by Vladimir Putin to recognize two areas of Ukraine as independent nations and to furthermore add quote-unquote peacekeeping forces. Does that mean that Vladimir Putin has invaded Ukraine? Well, it's a conversation a little bit more complicated than you might think. And we get the fullest picture that we have seen thus far into the logic of why the Biden administration has drawn so much attention to this particular issue, one in which they have said over and over and over again, the United States will not actively participate with boots on the ground. We are also going to shift away from Ukraine because I know as much as it heartens me that some folks who listen to this show appreciate me going through stuff and trying to organize my own thoughts and tell you guys about it with stuff that I am clearly not talented in understanding or analyzing, and I would put foreign affairs in there. We're going to talk about things that I do very much like to talk about, and I am a little bit more educated, and that is small town politics. This is the best part of the midterms. The two greatest part about the midterms is number one, the ads, because you get a lot of them. And some of them are low rent, made in iMovie. Some of them are super glossy, but you get a ton of ads. And the ones that stick out for a reason. The second best reason is that a lot of these races, especially while we're in the primary season, are retail politics, especially if you are somebody trying to make a name for yourself, break out of the pack a little bit. You got to do some stuff that you wouldn't otherwise do. You got to go to a few cities that may or may not be something that you would normally go to. And we had a very odd debate this week in Ohio. Two Senate candidates, one a Republican, in fact, the leading Republican, debating a Democrat who is seen as the underdog. And what happened was just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. And you're going to hear all of that sound. Also, Andrew Heaton joins the show. He wasn't able to make us for our triad episode, but we will talk with the old boy Heaton a little bit later in the program. But first, on Monday, Vladimir Putin gave a speech legitimizing two areas of eastern Ukraine as independent states. These are regions that have contained fighting between separatist groups and the Ukrainian government for a while now. More notably, Russia moved forces into those regions, with Putin calling them peacekeepers. And that was explosive enough. What followed was something that quite possibly raised more eyebrows. Specifically, if you are in the camp that Vladimir Putin indeed is going to take the step to invade Ukraine. Not annex a little bit, not nibble on the edges. No, he's going right to Kyiv. He is taking over the country. What Vladimir Putin said was kind of open musing. Why Ukraine? And to another extent, seemingly every part of the Russian Empire that was made a republic through the Soviet Union, by the way. Not even just what happened post-fall of the Soviet Union, what happened during the Soviet Union. Any piece of Russia that was cracked off into a republic that was part of the USSR, Putin challenged. Here is that clip.
We have a very important issue. Why did we have to meet any national ambitions, you know, on the suburbs of the former Russian Empire? Why did we have some great rights to these various territories? Why did we have to transfer the rights to the territories we have been historically part of the Russian Empire, and they've received even status of the national territorial units? Why? Why? Again, I am asking you, why did we have to be so generous? Even some ardent nationalists would not even dream of this. And then even give those republics the right to leave this union without any terms and conditions. This is just madness.
Now, the Biden State Department has been saying that Russia was not simply going to recognize those now recognized by the Russian Federation regions or fortify them with soldiers. They have said that Russia, again, will invade. As recently as last Friday, the president himself said Putin had made the decision to do so. We had the Secretary of Defense on television this weekend saying it was, quote, highly likely, unquote, that we would see tanks rolling toward the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. The United States wrote to the UN Human Rights Council this week to tell them that Russia had a quote-unquote kill list of Ukrainian diplomats and government officials to execute or imprison during this invasion. That is about as stark a relief as the United States can provide for what they believe is going to happen. And again, they have said it over and over and over again. That is what they believe, that Russia will invade Ukraine and that Vladimir Putin has already made the decision to do so. So the question that has to be asked based on the actions that happened on Monday is simple. Was that an invasion? Vladimir Putin putting Russian forces in these newly recognized regions? The answer from the Biden administration? Now, there will be sanctions. There was an executive order barring Americans from doing business with these two areas. On Tuesday afternoon, Biden announced a few freezes on Russian oligarchs. There's a bank that will no longer be able to deal with raising money for Russia. However, the U.S. did stop short on their biggest threat, and that was to remove Russia from the SWIFT bank, which is the international connection point. Basically, it would have required a gigantic consensus from effectively the entire Western world, and that has yet to happen. Why? Well, technically, Russian soldiers have been a part of that region for a while now. That is at least what is coming out of the Biden administration. So this isn't exactly an invasion because they're not moving into parts of the country that they were not already in. Speaking of Blinken, is he still going to meet with his Russian counterpart this week? Will Biden still meet with Putin? Hey, by the way, let's go ahead and flash back to January when Biden made what he called a gaffe, saying that a minor incursion of Ukraine wouldn't trigger big sanctions.
If it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
Unless Joe Biden was describing another kind of minor incursion, it seems like he didn't so much gaffe as he told the truth. For those who remember, the Biden administration spent the next 48 hours explaining to the Ukrainian government that they didn't exactly mean what it sounded like they meant. Although now it kind of feels like that's what they meant. And the Ukrainian government probably knows that. Now, here's where Biden's got a problem. Congress, who is out of town because, of course, is beginning to lose patience. And this is a bipartisan situation. Even Biden ally, Delaware Senator Chris Coons, he's also a Democrat, called for the big hammer to be dropped ASAP after the Monday moves. So what's happening to the people that are actually involved in all this? Well, Ukrainian President Zelensky urged everybody to be calm.
We are dedicated to a political and diplomatic settlement, and we are not falling into any provocations. Our borders well protected. We've built a system of territorial defense. Our partners supporting us. Ukraine retains the right for individual and collective self-defense. We can very well distinguish the provocations from the attack of the aggressor's troops. The truth is with us.
We are dedicated to the peaceful diplomatic solution, and we will follow this and only this path. We are on our land. We are not afraid of anybody and anything. We owe nothing to anybody, and we will not give anything to anyone, and we are confident about it.
Meanwhile, as of now, it seems as if our European allies are holding strong, maybe even in some areas stronger than us. The new German chancellor halted the certification of the Nord 2 pipeline connecting Russia to Germany, a massive source of money for some of the petro billionaires out of Russia. And because it's an oligopoly, the government of Russia. This puts the Biden administration in a bind. On one hand, a more aggressive posture from Putin legitimizes what everybody's been saying. He's a bigger threat than, let's say, ding-dong independent podcasters might have led you to believe. This isn't simply annexation, it's invasion. But, on the other hand, if you had this pegged from the jump, why not do what the country that is about to be invaded is asking you to do and hit Russia with sanctions immediately? Furthermore, now that there's more evidence, what's stopping you now? Does this begin to look a little bit like the situation that unfolded in Syria, where red line after red line is crossed because you believe that deterrents are threats and not promises? And let's shift it back to America. Unless American troops get shipped to Europe, more so than active duty troops that are already, you know, rotating through Europe, no one in the U.S. cares about Ukraine. And I would say many people don't care about Russia. I mean, honestly, it took the concept that the American president was a literal puppet of the leader of that country for us to really muster up much of a care for Russia. The reality is the country isn't as rich as China, and it doesn't have the same military capability. Yes, it has the big bombs, but in terms of any kind of ground fighting, they're just not the same beast. And we trade with them, but not to the level that we do our frenemy across the Pacific. This is a highlighted problem because the Biden administration has highlighted it. Otherwise, it would just be buried amongst the international news. The reason this has been public, according to one article in the New York Times that came out on Tuesday, is to keep NATO and Europe united. Instead of allowing Putin to sow discord amongst a union already jolted by, among other things, Trump, the Afghanistan debacle, the French submarine tiff, Biden sought to flood the zone with as much information as possible, both privately and publicly, about Russia's military buildup. According to the Times, this has been going on since November. And so far, it's worked. NATO has been resolute. Europe seems ready to threaten sanctions. But here's the big question. Will that still be the case if Putin simply stops here? An advancement into Ukrainian territory, although disputed, and some threatening words. But if he doesn't move tomorrow, and he doesn't move next week, and he doesn't move in a month, how long will everybody's patience last? How long before the dire warnings of invasion that we have heard now in public for at least a month, and that apparently all these NATO allies have been hearing for months, plural, how long before those ring hollow? I want to highlight a tweet that circulated last night. It's from just over 2 years ago. Amidst the Democratic primary, Joe Biden tweeted the following. Vladimir Putin doesn't want me to be president. He doesn't want me to be our nominee. If you're wondering why, it's because I'm the only person in this field who's ever gone toe to toe with him. Well, in terms of the world stage, upon the request of the American president, the floor is cleared. It is only Biden and Putin now. And I would say, for his own sake, you better hope he's as good as he says he is. When we did our big Ohio GOP primary breakdown a couple weeks ago, I don't remember when it is. Lots happening right now. We spent a lot of our time on J.D. Vance. Even though he is polling third right now, essentially tied for second, he has gotten the lion's share of the national press and has a lot more of an interesting backstory. The leader in this race, as of right now, is Josh Mandel. Politico has a great profile of him. He's one of those Republican politicians that understood where the tides were flowing, and despite the fact that he wasn't always a rock-ribbed MAGA man, he has certainly trended more toward there and is seen as a bit of a chameleon, but obviously popular enough with the MAGA crowd that he is currently leading. So this week, he did a thing that is just, I mean, you gotta love the midterms. They're just so ridiculous. He debated Democratic Senate primary candidate Morgan Harper. She is a black woman. Now, I'm going to tell you that you're not going to hear a lot of her, because Mandel is the one who dominates the stage here. And because you can't see what I'm going to play for you, this is a very small room. Think of a rec room that seems like it has maybe three or four rows of what I would guesstimate, based on the framing of the shot, is maybe 12 seats each. And that's overestimating it. It's a small room. I'm going to also say, from the context clues that you're about to hear, that this is in a African-American neighborhood. So before we even get into anything that Mandel is saying, there is a fight between the moderator, a woman in attendance, and Mandel.
Mr. Mandel, in your previous debate, you referred to Black Lives Matter as thugs.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then he come in the black community.
Hey, you're not doing that.
Put him out.
Please.
You mean like put him out like with a bullet?
Mr. Mandel.
What do you mean put him out?
Mr. Mandel.
Ask him to leave.
Mr. Mandel.
Oh, I thought this was America. I thought this was America. We can debate freely.
Hey, sister, listen to me. Don't do that. I got this. Don't do that.
They shouldn't have let him in.
No, this is America. He can be here. Don't do that. Don't embarrass me.
I'm not embarrassing you.
No, you don't
but
do that.
But to bring that white man in the black community like that.
You don't have to leave, man.
I'm finished.
Okay.
But
please,
don't you suck
ma'am.
Up to him.
Listen,
in the black community.
I'm doing my job. And
he's calling my parents thugs.
Ma'am,
I'm
the moderator.
Question.
I'm in charge. Yeah. I want you to sit down and be quiet.
Let me tell you something, ma'am.
Mr. Mandel.
I put my life in the hands of young black guys.
Mr.
I had young black men put their life in my hand in the United States Marine Corps and two tours in
I'm
Iraq.
Asking you to
so
stop,
don't stand
sir.
There and lecture me.
Mr.
Those
Mr.
are my
Mandel.
Brothers. Whether they were black or they were white
Mr.
or they
Mandel.
Were Hispanic or they were Asian, those are my brothers in the Marine Corps. So don't stand there and lecture me about race and color.
Mr.
We
Mandel.
Put our lives in each other's
Mr.
hands.
Mandel.
Those are my brothers as Marines.
Mr. Mandel, I'm the moderator over here. I'm asking you to pay attention to me. And ma'am, you in the calling post? Will you please stop?
All right.
Mr. Mandel,
there is something comedically hilarious about that final Mr. Mandel. It's just, it has such a rhythmic kind of percussion, and then it ends. Bah, big finish. We're not done. Mandel has some words for Harper. Of course, if you are a progressive young female politician, you are going to be compared to the most famous young progressive female politician in our modern worldview. That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And Mandel's got a comparison between AOC and Harper.
I told that story earlier about being at Town Hall, the bar and restaurant down the street, where I told folks that I'm going to debate Morgan Harper. She's like AOC, only smarter. After hearing that answer, I actually think she's like AOC, only dumber. Because the reality is...
You know, whenever there's an insult and you stumble over the insult, like, it just adds, chef's kiss. There's just something about awkward politician speak that just gives me such joy and power. And nothing compares to this. This is, I don't even know how to set it up. I don't even really know what to say. Just, here's the clip.
Morgan, do you know the only country on the whole planet where Africans were not brought as slaves? The Jewish state of Israel.
It should surprise nobody that Harper refused to shake Mandel's hand at the end of all of this. Now, in watching these clips, I kind of reflected back on the idea of like, okay, well, how have politics changed? How have Trumpian politics kind of changed? Because right now in the Republican side, I don't think it would benefit any of Mandel's opponents, J.D. Vance or anybody else, to really go after Mandel for being kind of a loon here. If anything, they would only draw attention to the fact that he was kind of Trumpian. I think the idea that he went to this area where it's a debate he didn't have to do, you know, he doesn't have to do this, but he sought out a fight. He got into a fight. Yeah, it was weird. Yeah, it was awkward. I think that's a positive for the Trumpian aesthetic in a way that I don't believe it would have been 8 years ago. I don't believe, I believe that a Republican who did that would be attacked by his primary opponents of, oh my God, what a clown show. Can we please get somebody with temperament to Washington? I do think that that is part of the meta right now, is demonstrate you will fight and you will say the thing no matter what. And Mandel did that, even if it is totally ridiculous. As for Harper, well, I think we kind of saw why she's in the background, right? If you see somebody throwing haymakers, you kind of got to throw haymakers back. I don't know if there is any honor in humility with politics like this. You got to stand up just like that lady in the audience stood up. I mean, even in the Democratic primary, I think that there is a reward, especially on the progressive side, of going out and fighting. Fighting is the new meta. Who wants to fight? Normally, friends, what I do here is direct you to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That is where you can get the bonus episodes of this show. $3 club. That is at the $3 level. You get a bonus podcast on Monday morning. That's the Sunday show. And then our late edition, that comes out on Thursday. That is the latest news that we cover during the week because our Friday show is prepared earlier. And you can look, very much, I love your support on all that. So thank you, everybody. And as we gear up to go out and travel for the primaries, trust me, your support is necessary. However, I am going to commandeer the rest of this ad slot so I can tell you guys about World's Greatest Con. And let me tell you your role in this new show that we are rolling out right now. About 2 or 3 years ago, I had the desire to step up my podcasting game. Previous to that, I was very much a student of the live-to-tape talk radio style of podcasting. This is a very functional way of doing things, and at its highest level, you can be extraordinarily successful. For example, you know, Daily Tech News Show, which is, I mean, I'm a part of and is, you know, the Tom Merritt Tech News franchise is something that is extraordinarily important to me in the history of podcasting and really my podcasting story. Applies that. So this is not to say that I don't believe in it, because I still do, but there was something that I wanted to develop, something that I was weak in that I wanted to get strong in. And that manifestation was Raise the Dead, researching, writing, producing, doing all of it in-house. Now that stuff takes a lot of time. You know, there's a reason why World's Greatest Con, or sorry, Raise the Dead, is only a handful of episodes. You can binge all of it in a day. Same thing with World's Greatest Con. But the time and effort that goes into these oftentimes 30 to 45 minute pieces of audio are immense. For me to build a production company, I need to have the financial assistance. And the financial assistance that I needed came from PX3. I will forever be grateful for you, this audience, for the fact that you guys have given me the platform to try and spread my wings and create more content that you guys will like. And if you like this show and you like to Raise the Dead, I guarantee you that you will like World's Greatest Con. It is hosted by Brian Brushwood. We co-created it. We have worked on every step of this together. It is the same production value, I would say better, than you either hear on this show or on Raise the Dead simply because I continue to evolve as a producer. The second season begins next Monday, February 28th. Many of you already heard the preview that we did on that we threw into the feed this Monday. I think it's exceptional. Having worked on it for many months, I think it is yet another step forward for Dog and Pony Show Audio. I believe that what we have coming, not only with that show in future seasons, but also other shows that are in development, is really rad. The talent we have brought in to help bolster the effort is, I think, exceptional. None of it begins without you, though. So while I ask you to go subscribe to World's Greatest Con, and I do believe you will enjoy it when season two begins on February 28th, just know that none of it is possible without the folks who support this show. Thank you very much. TakePoliticsSeriously.com is where you can go to continue that journey. Our guest today needs no introduction because he is one of our favorite guests of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the program, Andrew Heaton.
Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
Now, amongst everything that is going on in foreign policy with Ukraine and Russia.
Why did we buy that timeshare in Crimea? That was a horrible move in retrospect. We're not going to get that money back.
I mean, yeah, especially now we're going to have to change the currency twice.
Right.
There is another, what would normally be the number one story in American politics, and that is the naming of a new Supreme Court justice. So we have brought in the man who invented Judge Week to help us break things down. And this one has a little bit more.
I am about as close as you can get to an attorney without hitting six figures or being an attorney.
Down to the suits.
Right. Yeah. But otherwise, I'm like a proto attorney. I'm almost there.
I feel like you could slip into an attorney convention very easily.
For sure. Yeah.
No one would know.
And if
for
they
years.
Exist, hit me up. I'll come. It sounds like fun. I like totally. Attorneys. I like them. You can argue with them. They don't get mad at you.
There has been a controversy around the as yet unnamed Supreme Court justice that Joe Biden is said that he would name within the next week. And that is that it's going to be a black woman.
Right.
This has spurred a lot of conversation, some of which has been pointed that this is a racist move at the most inflammatory. The defense of it has been, well, you know, we've always had slots on the Supreme Court. There's the lady seat and the Jew seat and the Catholic seat. Like, it's just, we're just making a new seat.
That almost makes me want them to like carve sigils into it, like Game of Thrones, where it's like, here's the heart. Well, they're all Harvard or Yale, right? I think everybody except Amy Coney, Amy Barrett, I believe is Harvard or Yale.
Oh, really? And she's Notre Dame?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
She's one of us, Justin. She's a commoner. Finally.
Commoner who only went to Notre Dame.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my initial take on it is I think it was a dumb political move. I mean, this is more your department, knowing the actual politics of it and the logistics and tactics on the ground. I tend to be really thinky. That said, though, what kind of amazes me is if I were Joe Biden and I wanted to appoint a black lady to the Supreme Court, I would have gone, we are going to pick the best person for this job.
Yeah.
We're going to do it based on merit. And then we're going to pick a black lady. We're not going to say that part out loud. Because I think that, first of all, would be more beneficial to her in that whoever it is will not be viewed as affirmative action kick. You're right to point out this is something that's happened for a while.
You want the explanation of why it happened the way that it happened?
I would love it, yeah.
Because we're thinking of this in a void. That Joe Biden just said, I am going to name a black woman. He did not just say he's going to name a black woman. Same with him saying that he was going to name a black vice president, a woman vice president, and then most likely a black woman. He said those in the primaries. So to be president, to make these decisions, you need to shore up your constituency so you can make it through the primaries, so you can make it through the general. So these are him backing up promises that he made before.
Hats off that he both remembers them and intends to tends to honor them. That there's something to be said in that regard.
There are many powerful folks up to and including Jim Clyburn who would not let him forget.
The gentleman from South Carolina will remember whatever smoky backroom deal was required. You're also right to point out, because I normally share the kind of reflexive Republican, conservative, libertarian antipathy towards identity politics.
Yeah.
I very much am in agreement that we should attempt to move towards a colorblind society and look at people based on merit rather than the color of their skin. I am very much there with you. One of the things that, however, has been left out of that really angry kick against Joe Biden is that Trump did just that. I mean, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, very quickly, he's like, well, I'm going to appoint a woman for this seat, right? Well, that's the same thing that we're talking about is, but it really didn't count with Republicans because, well, they were getting a slot on the Supreme Court and it was their guy making the choice. They didn't care about it. And then Reagan did the same thing when he appointed
Sandra Day O'Connor.
Shout out to Reagan for appointing the first lady Supreme Court justice, but he plotted that out for everybody. So it's not like this is only a Democratic hat trick.
No.
The other things that I think are worth pointing out there is I do not know how to measure a Supreme Court justice's competency in metric tonnage. Like I feel like if we were just comparing aluminum prices, it'd be very easy to go, well, that's 32 cents a pound, but that's 43 cents a pound, dimwit. Yeah. Absolutely go with a 32. Supreme Court justice is a lot harder to do because you're looking at a resume of where they went to school, where they clerked, the decisions they've made, and so on and so forth, right? So I think that it probably would be more efficacious to think of it as a threshold that you're going to hit. And if you're within that threshold, then there is a little bit of flavor picking to it. Where I do find it odd with the black lady specifically, and that being the thing that we want to try and get on the Supreme Court is I would think that race and gender both would be of lesser concern in regards to intellectual diversity on the Supreme Court than it would for policymaking. Policymaking, I think that makes a lot more sense for because you're actually writing laws, you're making laws. The two fights that they're really having on the Supreme Court are, or the big fight is living constitutionalism versus originalism.
Yeah.
And that basically means, are you trying to strictly adhere to a textual analysis of the Constitution as it was written at the time it was passed? Or are you able to view the individual words as a bit more variable in order to better comport with our current situation? That's the big fight there.
And as I would encourage everybody to re-listen to Judge Week.
Thank you.
Because it is, it's fascinating to see not only the fact that everybody who is on either side of this argument can understand the other one, but also when they describe it, it's like, okay, living constitutionalists are like, well, this is the only way that it can be done. Anybody who does anything beyond this is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then the strict constitutionalists say that the folks who are the living document are like, no, you're doing that now to right. Read words in a modern context is to adapt things. So yeah, it's like there is a fascinating kind of divide there.
There is. And I'll add that for Judge Week, the reason that happened, that was a year and a half ago now, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, everybody started basically talking about the Supreme Court vacancy as, oh, red team gets to put in a red team quarterback.
Yes.
That was how everybody, full disclosure, my dad's a federal judge. I grew up hanging out with Tenth Circuit court jurists at barbecues and such.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of, I have thoughts on the judiciary and I know it to be far more nuanced and a different fight than just Republican versus Democrat. I'll add, literally every judge I've ever met, and I've met a lot at this point, would be horrified if their career was portrayed as that. Democrat or Republican, both. They would be horrified to be seen as
a political
partisan
puppet.
Activist yeah. that was going in independent of their jurisprudential ability. And I'll add, by the end of Judge Week, because what I wanted to do was go, hey, this is the actual thing that's happening right here. This is the real fight that's happening as understood by the jurists. I left feeling kind of good about it because everybody I talked to, I was like, you guys are on top of your stuff. Like there's not like dippy moron judges at the Supreme Court level. There are dippy moron senators and dippy moron legislators and a lot of them. There's not a lot of dippy moron, like, and I'm not saying you can't disagree with them and heinously disagree with them, but in terms of just a functioning branch, the judiciary is the last actual functioning, respectable branch of the American government. And I felt much better. And the thing that I have a big problem with, it turns out, is judicial activism. And both living constitutionalists and originalists would swear that they are not judicial activists and would also decry judicial activism as a perversion of the jurisprudence and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. It's so interesting to kind of see where the modern idea of the Supreme Court being a political organ is. And how much it's like, I've always kind of noted this, that like, there's also something that happens when you're appointed to something for life that like, I don't think gets factored into these conversations that we have of like, oh, I don't know, like a Republican's going in. It's like, yeah, but like what happens 30 years from now? Like what happens 20 years from now? Where is their perspective? Where is their judicial sense of all this? Now, that being said, the new justice, whomever she might be, is going to enter, I think, in a fairly interesting phase of the Supreme Court, because we might actually see a material change in the defining Supreme Court argument of our lifetime before either of us were born.
Right.
And that is Roe versus Wade. And that might come down, I think maybe before, no, not before, but still, she will, you know, not have, not be in the majority unless there's some sort of split decision there. But like, I wonder what our conversations look like in, let's imagine that Roe versus Wade is either weakened or ruled against based on this Mississippi case, if you're not aware of it. I wonder what our conversations look like when the only thing anyone ever talked about with the Supreme Court is gone. Whether or not you like the outcome, like, do we just look at, do we kind of like move on and now we'll start yelling at politicians finally to make laws based on these things that we care about?
I think the two reasons that the Supreme Court is understood as red versus blue. And like, I'll acknowledge that there is a certain amount of partisan inertia, which is, or at least partisan correlation, which is there. Like people that are, there's a lot of people, and I don't know if this is Republican or Democrat, but I hear it from my Democrat friends more, that judges are, you know, like let's quit pretending that they're not partisan. They are partisan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what bothers me about that is that's, I mean, ultimately the same authoritarian mindset of this is all smoke and mirrors, power is power, kind of Trump demagoguery that I fought against him. I don't think that about the Supreme Court. I think it's kind of dangerous rhetoric to view judges as, no, ultimately we are putting in partisans and anything else is lies. That's not where I want to be. I don't want the judiciary functioning like that. I don't think it currently does. The reason that we tend to view it as a separate, like super Senate, is two reasons. One, because the legislature is so dysfunctional that there is now administrative spillover going to the executive and judicial branches.
Yeah.
Where the executive branch has just swollen over the last 30 years because so much is now happening through the Federal Register, through just executive orders and agency regulation, because the House and Senate are no longer doing anything. And the same thing's happening to a lesser extent in the judicial branch. So the judicial branch is now doing more law than it would have done several years ago. But I think the main reason is people are just illiterate when it comes to these issues. And I put that pretty squarely on journalists, because I will read court court reporting, and it's horrible. Like, it's truly stupid stuff. Like,
how so?
So for example, leading up to 2020 or the 2020 election, you know, there's all this stuff going on about this state wants to get rid of, I don't know, early ballots, things like that, right?
Yeah.
I remember reading a story about Supreme Court sides with Republicans or something like that.
Yeah.
On like, and I don't, let's say Georgia. I don't remember the specifics on this.
Yeah.
And if you read it, what it very much looks like is the state, Georgia, calls the Supreme Court and goes, we would like to be pro-Republican in our election. And the Supreme Court went, well, we are Republican, and therefore we are pro-Republican. Yes, yeah. We side with the Republicans. The Republicans get +2 in the upcoming election.
Yeah.
And what was actually happening was there was a fight between the Secretary of State in the state and the governor of the state over whether or not they could do early voting or mail-in voting or something like that. But basically, the argument was, one, does the federal constitution preempt a state constitution in matters of federal elections? And two, within that state constitution, according to their state constitution, where does the buck stop in terms of this? Does the legislature do it, or does the executive branch do it according to their own laws?
Yeah.
Pretty clear, too. Like, this was not soupy stuff. That's why the Supreme Court did it. And it wasn't a divided decision. It was like, everybody but one voted in favor of quote unquote Republicans. The reason the Democrats did that was not because they were pro-Republican. It's yeah. because they all looked at the goddamn law books.
Yeah.
And
by Democrats, you mean the justices appointed by a
Democratic
president.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I find that that's very common with law reporting, is that you get somebody that does not. I was balking at that reporting because it was willfully ignorant. I mean, it was just, they grabbed somebody whose job was normally to write about partisan politics, and then went, I don't know, go look at this judge thing. And like, they didn't listen to Judge Week. I'll tell you that much. and I'll tell you, they also clearly didn't read any of the stuff. They did not read the actual, because you can go, this is all publicized stuff. You can read it. And by the way, judges speak way better English than lawyers do, because they're not trying to impress you. Yeah. They're already judges. They've already made it.
They are kings of their profession. There's, by the way, they serve for life.
Right. They have no impetus to let you know they speak Latin. They don't care.
Yeah.
So when you read their briefs, they're pretty good. Like there will be the phrases that you don't know. Right. Yeah. But for the most part, you can read it and follow along. The person had clearly not even done that. It was being paid to report on this. And so I think that happens, and as a result, people are basically told subconsciously or directly that jurists are just appointed senators, and their job is to be this corollary to the Senate of super lawmakers, and they're not lawmakers. No judge claims to be a lawmaker, and if they are, they should be shot. Judges' jobs are to clarify the law.
This gets into where I think you can have, this is a little journalism thing. If you want to show bias without being quote unquote biased, you play the game of classification. So it's like, in an era when Donald Trump was being very mean to journalists, and journalists by and large did not like Donald Trump, between whatever their personal politics were and the fact that Donald Trump was like making sport of making fun of them. Anything that happened in the Trump White House was Trump White House blank.
I also noticed
Trump makes all hunting legal or whatever. Right. And it's like, okay, well, the Environmental Protection Agency issued some ruling that usually nobody would ever care about, but you can say this because it's Trump White House. Or it's like Republicans aligned, you know, Republicans held up by Supreme Court, not Secretary of State of Georgia upheld or rejected by Supreme Court.
Or like the other one that I was almost impressed by was, I remember it was like, I don't know, the New York Times, the Washington Post or something. And it was referencing, you know, Rand Paul used the filibuster, a tactic created during the Jim Crow years to keep segregation in place, to keep going. And I was like, they never do that with minimum wage. They never say minimum wage, founded by white supremacists to make sure that white people could compete with black people in labor, By the way, look that up. That's historically true. They don't do that. I think that kind of stuff does happen.
Even then, that I think is another. That's another thing. That is adding a tactic. Mm. You know, adding the selective history
just clarification or classification, as you said.
Classification. Yeah. So it's like, now, if Joe Biden, at least as we record this right now, who knows in a year if it's going to be different, that is very well liked by journalists, or at least more so than Donald Trump was. If something happens in the EPA, it'll be EPA relaxes, thing, as opposed to Joe Biden relaxes whatever regulation. Like, that's it. And part of it also is beyond the partisanship of it, which I think we tend to focus on, there's also just the knowledge of the readership of it. You know, one of the tenets of journalism is, how does this affect my reader? How can I bring it as close to them as possible? Let them understand that it's possible. If I just give people the phone book, then they're not going to read it. They're not going to understand it. And everything that we've done research wise is totally wasted. It's the reason why newspaper design exists. Like, not because art people wanted to make the words look fun, but because it's more readable. It's their scientific demonstration of, like, okay, well, this is why it works, because your brain shuts off when you see too much gray space. By the way, for everybody who's starting Substack letters, for the love of God, break stuff up every once in a while. Like, you all need to learn a lesson in magazine and newspaper layout. But I can see from that perspective that you're like, oh, okay, well, the average reader cares more about Republicans and Democrats than they do about secretaries of state or Supreme Courts. Mm. But I think that you can go too far.
You could clarify that. Like, I would probably not bring up Democrat versus Republican if I were reporting on the Supreme Court normally, because I do think that's a correlation rather than causation.
Also, let me point this one other thing out, is that reporters don't write headlines. Editors write headlines.
This wasn't the headline. This was the description. Yeah. But the headlines for sure, though, right? Like, one of the you came on a bonus episode, which is really fun, about 6 months ago, where I was like, all right, I very much opposed to Trump, preferred Biden over Trump. Yeah. Get that out there. But like, when Trump screwed up, it was like, Trump screws up. That's the headline. When Biden screws up, it's challenging week for Biden.
Yeah.
like he's
dadgummit.
He's the protagonist we're rooting for. And I've noticed that like the example you gave that was really good was like when McCarthy and Boehner, I don't remember who it was, couldn't get a budget passed. It was like, Republicans failed to pass budget.
Yeah.
Here about 4 months ago, when the same thing happened in the House with the exact same.
It's still happening.
Yeah.
They just kicked the can down the road again.
But the headlines, again, because they couldn't pass it because the Tea Party had an insurgency, all that. Republicans failed to pass it. But Democrats, it was progressive stand up in budget fight. Like, oh, okay, yeah. So that, yeah, definitely there's some color that seeps into the headlines.
Sure, yeah. And you know, I don't know. I mean, this, of course, I've finally successfully taken the Supreme Court conversation and turned it into the only real story that ever exists, journalism. I think the Supreme Court is a uniquely interesting case, because I think there is a lot of really, really, really good judicial reporting. Like, you don't have to scratch the surface far to get, especially in the blogosphere and in podcasting, excellent coverage.
There's some really good podcasts of this kind of stuff. I agree, yeah.
What has not happened.
Lawfare, I want to say, is pretty good. Yeah.
What has not happened is had it trickle up to kind of what we understand to be our kind of lead dogs in terms of the journalistic conversation.
Can I give my quick stump speech now that we're going back to the Supreme Court on diversity hires within these fields?
Please do.
My position on affirmative action in general is, I think, all things being equal, you want to use that as a tiebreaker. That makes sense to me. If you've got a limited amount of spaces that you're giving to college students or something, and you go, all right, these two are equally qualified, they both passed the threshold, let's err on the side that makes whatever body we're creating more diverse. The idea being that more ideas and perspectives are good. That makes sense to me. I'm on board with that. The problem that I have so often in terms of its execution is, I do not think the people that are oftentimes proposing that are good faith actors. And the reason I say that is, I find that a lot of the people that are championing diversity, man, they have a real problem with diversity of thought. They do not like that at all. I find that to be pretty common within the academic sphere at the moment.
Yeah.
A lot of our friends in journalism as well, where they're like, no, we want diversity. We want a Black person that agrees with me and a Chinese person that agrees with me. And also, by the way, they're sacrosanct now because they're a person of color, so you can't criticize them or you're racist. So basically what I want to do is weaponize my beliefs and put it in a position where you're never allowed to criticize them. And like that, I have a problem with.
Yeah.
Because no one's talking about giving Thomas Sowell a Nobel Prize in economics. Nobody's talking about putting Deidre McCloskey on the Supreme Court.
Joe Biden, when he nominates who I assume will be a fantastically qualified woman to that position, will not begin his speech with, in the grand tradition of Clarence Thomas.
Yes, exactly.
That will not be a part of the speech. Let me ask you something, and this is probably getting us into dangerous waters here.
Yeah, right.
But when we talk about diversity, and this is something that I've put a little bit of thought into, are we playing is the goal? Let's say we have diversity, things, right? Practices in place. Is it too a demographic? Is it too all right, in our population, we have 15% African-American, we have 8% Asian, we have whatever, right? Is that the goal? Is the goal to be representative to population, or is it just to weight applications of what we understand as historically underserved communities higher than what we understand to be privileged communities?
I think it depends on what you're trying to do. Is your goal to attempt to level the playing field and rectify past historical injustices, or is your goal to get multiple viewpoints? They're not necessarily juxtaposed against each other or contravened, but there is a prioritization that you're going to select ultimately in regards to that, right? So if I were putting together a writer's room,
yeah,
I would be far more concerned about different viewpoints, because I'm concerned about they're going to be white guy humor is going to make sense to me. Airplane. I don't know what white guy humor would even be. I'm sure I'm dead in the middle of it, of Zucker Brothers, whatever that, Dave Barry, whatever that is. I'm in that, right?
Sure.
I would it's going to be very helpful to our writer's room to have other perspectives, but I would not be thinking in that instance hard about writer's rooms have been dominated by white males and we really need to try and reset I'm not thinking as hard about that. It might be a good idea as well, but my primary thing would be in that instance to produce the best humor I can, which would be through really funny people. And then after that, through a medley of different perspectives. If you're doing it to rectify past historic injustices, which, is a guy that prefers equality of opportunity over equality of outcome, I think is a thing we should be striving for. Not everybody has equal opportunity in our country. I would like to have a level playing field for everybody to start at, right? If you're doing that, it would seem to me that it would be better to go socioeconomic than it would be to go demographic. And I think that that's one of the kind of sneaky things that affirmative action can sometimes do, where I think there are policies in place, with the big exception of Asian people, at Harvard that now weights this a little bit better. But at least 10 years ago, my understanding is that a lot of the Ivy League institutions would have, a quota or a diversity system to some extent, but they would be going after doctor's kids.
Yes.
Who are black, doctor's kids who are whatever. And I'm like, I don't know that really is what we're going for here. Right. Meanwhile, if you're poor and you're white, I'm not like, haha, serves you right. Right.
But even then, it's so we want more poor kids at Harvard? Does that make Harvard better? Does that make America better? Does that make...
I think Harvard is, to a great extent, an elitist, classist blood clot. You think about the amount of people that are there because they put in a bunch of money, or because their dad went there. I mean, that's just straight up snobbery, right? Get rid of that. Get rid of that, then we can talk, right? I would much rather lop off the top of people that are not there through merit. When you actually make it a meritocratic institution, which it is not, there's good data on this. Harvard is not a meritocratic institution. I don't know as much about Yale and the other Ivy Leagues, but my guess is they're similar. A significant amount of the people there are there because they got in based on dad or donations.
Sure. Yeah.
Take care of that. And then we can kind of talk about what do we want to do with these
other
things?
Also, that's my thing, is I don't really care about the Ivy Leagues. I don't care about, I don't know, maybe this is my own bias, because going to Syracuse next to Cornell, I used to refer to us as their dumber, hotter sister school. But
that's funny. Yeah.
I don't really care. I think one of the things that is fascinating to me about any kind of diversity stuff is the gate in which people decide, this is where we need to diversify. This is where we need to take action to diversify. Very often says a lot about them because they believe that is a place that will make a difference. And I don't mean that in any kind of negative way. I mean that in a very illuminative way that, like, if you believe it's at college that we need to be doing this. It's at elementary school. Mm. It's at high school. It's at Burger King. It's wherever it needs to be. I think it says that, like, you believe this is a choke point, that this is a glass ceiling that, however you want to describe an underserved community, be it socioeconomic or racial or ethnic or anything in between, that's where we need to poke some holes to allow, you know, a difference in there. But I don't quite know for me where that line is. I know that I don't care if the poorest person I've ever met in my life goes to Harvard. Yeah. Like, mostly because I don't care much about Harvard. Mm. Like, but I do think that there are places in which our society can, you know, help other people along. I just don't know where that is.
Yeah. I mean, I return to, like, there is that difference of, is diversity the goal in and of, is diversity inherently good? If it is, the people militating against it, I would argue, might want to try to increase the number of divergent voices in their newsrooms or in their academic areas in terms of viewpoints, which does not seem to be a big thing right now. It seems to be going much the other direction. If it is I get the argument too of for hiring quotas and things like that. The idea is, even if we don't look at the obvious racism that has happened in the history of the country, and we just look at people that aren't racist, people do tend to like and trust people that look like them and come from a similar background. And so the idea would be that there is a kind of feedback loop of white male guy going on. I get that. Figure out what you're trying to solve for first. I don't know. I've become a bit disenchanted with some of these arguments for diversity. And then the other thing I'll add too is that, to get to your point about at what level and choke point, I think that is a really interesting question, because a kind of like ongoing debate in American history, particularly since the civil rights movement, and I think within the Democratic Party is where this is really the interesting thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think Republicans are arguing about this as much, is what is the primary group that is besieged? Is it race or is it socioeconomic? Bernie's saying, like, and if you say socioeconomic, you're not automatically racist. But like, Bernie Sanders thinks in terms of class, right? So Bernie Sanders thinks in terms of, there are poor people, which includes white folks in Appalachia and black folks in Georgia and black people living in slums in New York and Latin Americans, right? But it's a class-based thing.
Yes.
With rich people at the top crapping on them. Or is it a racial hierarchy? And you do see these two different worldviews kind of grind. I think you see it more in the Democratic primaries. I'm sure, like, when you get into the tent of academic arguments and things, that it's more heated there. I think it's more to do with socioeconomic stuff. Racism exists, blah, blah, blah. Like, yes, it exists. There's all of the, but I think that from where I'm looking at, I think that it is more more correlation with class than it is like all white people are automatically in a caste and all black people are below that caste and that kind of thing. I don't think the numbers bear out on that.
Oh yeah. I mean, I tend to think.
Do I get canceled? I feel like we're in dangerous territory now.
I think we are in dangerous territory, but I will say that I do think that class, look, I think that the children of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett
are going to be okay
more than somebody that was, like, you know, birthed into a toilet somewhere like in Appalachia. Like,
one of my ex-girlfriends, I didn't meet her in Oklahoma, but she's from Oklahoma.
Isn't going to end with a toilet, is it?
It's not going to end with a toilet. But when we were dating, she couldn't call her dad because her dad is so poor, he doesn't own a phone. Yeah. Not he's a hip guy that believes that social media is poisoning your mind. And he's not writing letters with a quill. He doesn't own a phone because he's that poor. Right. And I look at that kind of guy and, like, I get why that guy's angry, because we're like, you have every opportunity in the world, dickhead. Like, you're a white guy. And it's like, well, like, no, he's clearly had a tough time. And then the flip side of that, I think, to like round out the now dangerous racial church we're getting into, I think, like, when we get into concepts of privilege, which do exist there, I think that it's frequently mangled in our culture in terms of what we're actually trying to say. Because that guy that I just described, my ex-girlfriend's dad, if we're talking about privilege, I think he would justifiably get angry because he would feel like he had zero opportunity in life and that kind of thing. And a lot of people, I find, if you talk about privilege, what they're hearing is you don't deserve the success you've had. If not him. We're now talking about somebody else listening to your show, middle class, upper five figures, six figures, exactly. Whoever you are, right? When they hear, you know, you're privileged and their people aren't privileged, what they're hearing is you do not deserve the success that you have. It was given to you, which I don't think is the case. I think a lot of the people that get angry about that justifiably are like, I worked really hard to be where I'm at. Nobody gave me anything. And I'm not discounting that. But I think that it's more like if you're running in a marathon and other people have hurdles in front of them, like you ran the marathon, dude, you deserve credit for that. Like, yeah. Good job. You worked hard. You worked 80 hours a week. I'm not disputing that. But there are people that have hurdles in front of them that couldn't compete in the same capacity. And that's what we're talking about, is they didn't have those speed bumps and hurdles. And those are the things that we have to break down that are part of systemic institutionalized racism.
I do also think that part of the American way of looking at the world is absence of class. We don't have the same kind of class thoughts.
No, we're a lot more culturally fluid with class than the British are.
Well, certainly. I mean, Jesus, the British are the worst when it comes to that, at least.
No, it's amazing because you're like when I first went to England, like I talked to people that are like millionaires, and they're like, no, I'm a Cockney. I'm always going to be working class.
Yeah.
I can't do a good Cockney accent. But I was sure. like, you get $1 million. Like, doesn't count. Well, no, I'm right. Nope, still go to the right.
It's funny. I was listening to, and I forget where, but it was some conversation between, Christopher Hitchens and his brother, who would often have, they were on kind of opposite sides of the aisle and they would have sort of debates. But the one thing that they could agree upon was that in America, you're American fairly quickly. Like, you're American if you own a house in America. Like, mm-hmm. Americans want you to be an American really bad. And so it's like, if you vacation here 3-4 times a year, we're like, dude, you're American. Like, you just admit it. Like, where in England, if you move to England, like, maybe your great-grandson's great-grandson would be considered British. Mm-hmm. Like you have generations before anybody forgets, like, nah, still kind of American. Yeah. Still kind of, and I think class-wise, it's similar. It's like, I mean, you made some money. Good for you. But I don't know. You're still I know where your grandfather came from. I don't trust you.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty accurate. Yeah,
but I do think that some of that does exist here, and I think that while we very much believe in our ability to transcend it, I think that sometimes comes with the shortcut of believing that they don't exist or that these things don't exist, and that ultimately, it is very easy to move from kind of a middle class world to a upper class world in America, where I think it is more difficult to kind of go from especially an extreme poverty level to a middle class world. And since most of the voices, including the voices you're hearing right now, come from either middle class or upper middle class upbringings, there is not a whole lot of perspective on that. And therefore it is just by its very nature sort of under understood.
I mean, I think regression to the mean is a phenomenon. Like, you are apt to not stray too far from where you were tethered to. Obviously we all want upward mobility and class fluidity to be a thing in the United States. We want people to be able, everybody does.
Preferably it. One way.
Preferably one. Well, you know what though? Like, I got to say this, if you're like, I don't know.
For me, I'm saying preferably
if
one way.
If you're some celebrity,
going good now
you're,
for me.
You're some celebrity's kid that doesn't do anything with your life and you're born rich, I hope you piss your money away. And you're like,
damn.
Like, I don't want you to be poor. I just don't want you to be permanently rich. I want there to be a ratchet effect where you and your kids go down to being middle class and then one of them has to like learn a skill or something. Or to put it another way, there ought to be room for failure and there ought to be room for rebound. The obligatory stuff I'll add to that, because now I'm going to swing back against Bernie Sanders.
Go.
So Bernie Sanders will talk about how, and AOC I'm sure would do this as well, although I can't quote her, so maybe I'm wrong, but I bet she is. We'll talk about how like ossified our class structure is, and they'll point to like, you know, the working class hasn't got a pay increase in 50 years or whatever the thing is, because they think of class as a caste system where you are born a chimney sweep and you are not allowed to be anything but a chimney sweep. But I was born into the clerical class. So my class, but that's not how that works. Like, I make way more money now than when I was 23.
Yeah.
I wasn't making money when I was 23. But if you were looking at statistically, you would say, all the people making working class jobs are making the same amount. They're not the same people. Like, you start in a lower income job, you work your way up. If we were living in like an Indian caste system, that would be truly horrifying. But we're not. Yeah. We do have that fluidity. The vast majority of people are earning more money in their 40s than they were in their 20s. For those who aren't, yeah, that's a thing. We need to work on that. And like, one of the things I'll say, like, because this is another reason we do need diversity, right? And I would prefer it be from a socioeconomic background or being from an intellectual background as opposed to a demographic background. Because somebody like me needs somebody to come in and go, oh my God, you are so like in la la land. Because I don't know, I didn't have to deal with that stuff, right? Like, something that I've noticed is when I was in college, one of my really good friends started going to university. He dropped out after a couple of years. Very smart guy, a polymath, but he didn't have the money for it, and just didn't really have the life tool set to just go to the bursar and be like, what are my options here?
Yeah.
Or go to a loan. Like, he just didn't know any of that stuff. His parents hadn't gone to college, were not supportive in that endeavor. I've seen that. I've got obvious privileges. My dad was in the state legislature when I was a kid. So government feels very normal and very comfortable to me. I have no problem strolling into the ombudsman's office and making an appointment because I want to talk about bike racks or something. That's perfectly normal to me. For a lot of people, they don't know any of that stuff. It's just this kind of big maze of people in suits that are going to look down on them. I think there's a lot of that, a lot of just not having the same networking capacity or middle class knowledge and that kind of thing. We need to work on that. That's a thing where we don't want anybody to be stuck there. We want it to be an upward mobility phenomenon.
I think that's the ideal. The ideal is that you again, can
unless
be
you're
what
the
you want.
Layabout kid of a celebrity, I want you to be knocked
in that
down
case,
to
please.
Six figures max.
You should be forced to wear stone shoes.
Yeah.
I think that is the ideal. The ideal is that you can move according to your merit. You can move according to your effort. You can transcend a class. And that, again, I do think it happens here more than most places. I think that this is a tremendously rich country that money spills all sorts of places. And we don't necessarily have the same kind of rigid class structure like you were mentioning before. But it is interesting. Heaton, boy. What a journey.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. Political Orphanage, what do you got coming up?
Let's see here. I've got some cool stuff in the works. I just did an episode on psychedelics that I'm going to commend to your audience. That was really fun. I brought on Sarah Siskin, a very, very funny comedy writer, but she does a show in New York on psychedelics where she interviews neuroscientists. So she's very informed about it. So it is a good conversation where you learn stuff from a very funny person about psychedelics. Then I brought on Ayla, who is a high-end, I'm trying to get my OnlyFans person.
Okay.
What some people might call a cam girl.
Sure.
And a former escort.
Gets
naked on the internet.
Yeah.
And did LSD every week for a year. And I found out about that and was like, I would love to talk to you about what the hell that's like. And so did just a fun episode on psychedelics that is a good blend. You'll learn some stuff, but it's a fun episode. So I'd recommend that to your audience.
It's funny how psychedelics in terms of the legal framework is kind of somewhere in between. Like before, I feel like when we were growing up, it used to be among the scariest drugs.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because you were going to like there's a great, I think it's Bill Hicks. Like, cause you were going to, you know, do LSD and jump out a window. Cause you think you could fly. And Bill Hicks is like, if you thought you could fly, why would you start on the second floor?
Right?
Why wouldn't you just go out in your yard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just try to fly from there. And now I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's between the fentanyl and the opioids that now we've had like a reordering of like the scariest possible drugs.
Plus I think like the
big win for acid and cocaine.
The elite have all been doing drugs. Like all the people that are now running the law probably dropped acid when they were in college, you know, or did mushrooms a couple. Like I'll say like real quick, like I hung out with a lot of Republicans when I was on the Hill, and they all smoked pot when they were in college. Like whatever they were telling the constituents,
they were saying,
they all smoked pot in college, if not later. And then there too, just the data is a lot better now, right? Like when Dennis Leary was I'm thinking of the right guy, Dennis Leary,
No, Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary. Thank you. Dennis Leary. Similar, but different.
Speaking of ripping off Bill Hicks.
Yeah. When Timothy Leary was doing it, there was a real panic about it, and it was bending reality and all that. And now we can look and go, oh, yeah, like we know that psychedelics do not have inherently addictive properties the way alcohol, opiates, tobacco, nicotine do. We know that it's a lot more difficult to OD on them, if that's even possible, than it is with these other substances, in a way that I think just the data is really difficult. I mean, like, there are still smart, well, I would disagree with them. There are smart cases to be made that you shouldn't, they need to remain controlled and prohibited, et cetera, but it's very difficult to make a medical case that they are somehow worse or more dangerous than fentanyl.
Heroin. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And fentanyl, I mean, geez, fentanyl, you're not going
to. You don't tend to dabble in fentanyl. It's not like you're drinking a beer. You're like, I'll just have a little bit of fentanyl after work, and then maybe I'll drive to the club.
I've always heard the stories, or I've heard the maxim that like every drug has a casual user. Like,
yeah, okay.
That there is somebody out there that, well, number one, spoiler alert for anyone who's ever read a magazine or watched an advertisement, but there is very casual cocaine use in those fields that is just a normal, regular workaday cocaine use. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if that's the case with fentanyl, just because it is so potent. But then again, you never know.
Yeah.
If you're a casual fentanyl user, please check write out in the show, yeah. theyoungamerican@gmail.com. I'm glad I gave out the email address and not the P.O. box. Heaton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. Thank Heaton for being on the show. I know he's been on a lot, but everybody likes a compliment. px3guest.com. That is letter P, letter X, number 3guest.com. You want to email the show? Do it. theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Send the show a tweet at px3tweets. You can see me live on the internet, px3live.com, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Friday mornings. Our podcast can be shared with your friends, family, and clergy at px3podcast.com. And of course, our merch can be found at politicsmerch.com. Somebody got a tapestry. All right? They sell tapestries. All of our art you can put on mugs and shirts and all sorts of stuff. But they also sell tapestries. Somebody bought a tapestry of All Power's Future Power, which is amazing. I'm going to need to see a picture of the All Power is Future Power tapestry and where it goes up. Of course, you can always support us at paypal.me/payjury with a one-time donation. Same thing with Venmo, Justin-Young-20. The Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can hit us with anything physical in the mail, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Again, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Just make sure you make it out to your old pal, Justin Robert Young. And of course, the only way you can get bonus content is by heading on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the podcast like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Idris Arslandian, DJ Katie Mack, Niemeister, Dr. G, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicetti, 70s TV Salesman or Spy, D. Really, and vote for Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, Zombie Doc, Edison, no mention on the podcast, please, .com Junkie, DP4 Bongo, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Staff Sergeant Poopers, Berkeley Steven, Diana's Silent Slumbers, Katie Stetch, Adam L., Double K Ranch, EO Pinball Shop, John, the Opposing Thumbs for Dogs Foundation, Super Zoomy, Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Matt, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Dustin, Richard, D. Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age, Mike, The Gen, J Pink, and Andrew. You want your name read amongst them? Would you? Huh? I would. I mean, I can read my name because I do the podcast. I say my name all the time, so I guess I don't need it. But if you would like to, you should head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Until next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss. Oh!
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.